Howdy, soda booze. Welcome to the Club Soderberg, the podcast that never ends. Grab your club soda-based cocktail and settle in. Today I'm joined by co-host Carla Donnelly.
Hello.
And Jessie Scott.
Hello.
And we'll continue our endless love for the oeuvre of Steven Soderberg. We are also excited to welcome our guest today, fellow soda nerd, Lee Zachariah. Lee is a film buff, writer and TV producer, and podcaster of an interview show about all things movie that you should listen to called Hell Is for Hyphenates. Lee, tell us a bit about your good self and your relationship to Steven Soderbergh.
Well, Steven and I live together in a chateau. No, sorry. Oh, the real, not in my head, right? Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be back on the show. And forgive me if I tell the exact same story I told last time. But basically, I was at film school and a friend got his hands on a copy of The Limey. And this was back in the Middle Ages when if a film didn't come out in Australia, you were never going to see it. So the fact that he ordered this DVD was a huge deal. And so we got a lecture theatre in the middle of the night and watched it. And I was just blown away. It was one of the few films I've seen in my life that kind of changed how I saw film. And then at the same time, sort of Erin Brockovich came out and Traffic came out. And I was like, oh, this is, I think I'm falling for this guy, this Soderbergh. he's possibly my favourite filmmaker. And I've spent a good portion of my life now trying to figure out why his films speak to me in a way that so many others do not. So,
what's your favourite film of his?
The Limey.
I think you just told
it. I hoped it would be Erin Brockovich.
No kidding, Erin Brockovich, top three. Okay. Yeah.
But what did you conclude after all of this?
I'm still trying rumination to figure it out.
You can't figure it out why he hooks into you so much.
I think there's something he does, the way he gets close to people. Mm. And this is such a minor thing, and it's not the reason, but it might be emblematic of the reasons that he never does wide shots. He never does the establishing shots to here's where we're about to go. He's always just in the faces of the people. It's always point of view stuff, like really intimate. And I think that might be the key to sort of his larger, I think there's so many more reasons, but I think that might be sort of the Rosetta Stone of why he's, you know.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, when you say that, I immediately think about all the starts of his films and how they are often, like his establishing shots are point of view shots usually. Mm. Yeah.
And usually a voiceover, you know, before you see what's happening, you know. Yeah.
But then everything else is movement, and that's the thing that I love. Like when everybody's on them, there's no kind of panning or anything like that. As you say, it's like he's with the people as they're moving. There's, you know, transition shots shot from a car as they're driving away. That I love the way that the films are stitched together. It feels really kinetic and alive as opposed to kind of like a static character study as a lot of those stayed still.
I think
wide shot films feel like.
There's all these stories about him shooting a scene and going, this isn't working. Let's go to a bathroom and shoot it in there. And then it's like, where did that come from? But it's like it's the energy of that, I think, feeds into everything he makes because he's always like, let's do something to get the energy. He can identify if something's not working even if every technical element is in place. Mm. And, yeah, maybe because he always brings that, maybe that's why. Mm. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Lee. Today is a special episode with two very interesting films. First, we'll jump back in time and talk about the super low budget film that Sodi shot in 10 days back in late 2009 when he was in Sydney directing the stage play Tot Mum for Cate Blanchett's Sydney Theatre Company. This film is a clear diversion from his One for Them, One for My Practice. This one was for the actors of the play, and it was never released. It's rarely seen and very hard to get one's hands on, and we have seen it. So stay tuned because there'll be more about that in a minute. And then Back to the Future, the second film we're going to look at is Soderbergh's most recent film that's been released, Unsane. It came out in early 2018 and it's now available in DVD rental booths at supermarkets.
Which is where I got my copy.
I watched it when it was out in cinemas for about 5 seconds earlier in the year. And it had a very low budget, $1.5 million. It was experimentally shot on iPhone. And it definitely falls into the One For Me projects category for Soderbergh. It treads new ground, I think, in that it has a really great female lead and seems to be explicitly paying homage to the feminist zeitgeist of contemporary America, which is, I think, new ground for Soderbergh. But more about that. Without further ado, I'm going to throw to Lee Zachariah to talk about Michael Gregg.
The last time I saw Michael Gregg traces a production of Chekhov's Three Sisters by the Sydney Theatre Company. We start on opening night and then travel backwards to see how this fraught production came to be, as directors quit or disappear and the cast struggles with insecurities, affairs, and a lead actor who may or may not be able to read. I'm not going to go into too much detail because, as has been flagged, this film has not actually been released, and I feel like it would be probably best not to go into too much detail about the plot at this time. So I feel like I should tell the story of how I came to be in possession of it, which is frustrating because it's a story I can't tell. It is perhaps more thrilling than the film itself. I guarantee it's filled with twists and turns, accidents and miscommunications, and it's maybe the best anecdote I have, and I cannot tell it. Even if Michael Gregg, the film, does eventually see the light of day, this story cannot. So I will have to take that to my grave, I'm afraid. But so I, as you said, I do a podcast, Hells for Hyphenates, which is based on the premise of covering a different filmmaker each month. And in 2012, we were talking Soderbergh. So, bolshy nerd that I am, I thought I'd make a play to get my hands on the copy of his famously unreleased film. And amazingly, I did. Because a few people placed a lot of trust in me. I'd been so determined to cover my tracks. And this is true. In the intervening years, I have contacted as many of the cast members as possible. I've emailed some. I've met others in person. I know nobody really cares, but if anyone ever did try to figure out who my source was by tracing the relationships I have with the cast, they'll at most be able to narrow it down to, like, half the cast. So,
I bet Sodi could figure it out.
I'm sure he could, because I think he can
do anything. He'd make a film out of it.
But yeah, I feel quite responsible to protect my sources. But here's the thing. I also feel a responsibility to my fellow soda nerds, legion that we are, because, like, in the world of film and television, there are all these, like, missing films and famously missing episodes of old TV shows, and along with those come the rumours that someone is hoarding something that no one else has seen, like collectors just hold on to these things, and I have an intense dislike for these people because, I don't know, I just can't understand the selfishness. Things are more enjoyable when you share them. And that's why I wanted to share it with you guys, because I sincerely hope everyone will get the chance to see this film one day. If they do, it won't be because of me. I guard my copy carefully, as you guys know. when I show it to people, I am in the room, always near the player. And the rest of the time, it's unlabeled in a secret place. So anyone who wants to rip open my house to look for it will not be able to identify it. The flip side of that is, because it's so rare, and because the fact of possessing this film is so impossible, I think I value it more than really any other of his films. Like, I haven't even ordered the Criterion box set of Che yet.
Not even.
No, and I am... If that box was designed for anyone... Because, like, I mean, it looks beautiful. I love those films, but I always know that it's going to be perpetually available, you know, at least in a practical sense. And, like, I haven't even seen season two of The Nick. And I loved season one. Mm. Like, there's always time. Whereas, like, all screen works in the 21st century kind of feel devalued because of their ubiquity.
Mm.
And the internet has been a blessing and a curse. I've seen films I would never be able to see otherwise, but every piece of art, every piece of information is instantly available. And because we don't have to work for it, I feel we don't value it. And that's why I value this film so much.
Mm.
Did you guys have a sense of that at all when we watched it, that we were seeing something rare and special, or was it just like another film or like a lesser work?
I think it did because of how much you completely freaked out when we weren't sure if the DVD was going to work. And you're like, that's the only copy I have. I did get that sense. Yeah. I think it's an interesting, really interesting point you raise, especially about the internet. And it's a feeling that I've never articulated, but hearing you say it, it's true that I often think, oh, I might buy something that I really love, some movie that I really love, and then I just go, oh, what's the point? You know, I can watch it on Netflix or that'll always be downloadable somewhere. So, yeah, it did feel like this weird little artifact, this kind of, physical object that was finite.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I definitely felt very privileged to be watching it, although I have to admit, because it is so dialogue heavy and the sound wasn't awesome, I probably didn't hear most of it.
Right.
Didn't hear most of the dialogue. So any of the action scenes in it, I really valued.
It is an action-heavy film, all the car chases.
Particularly liked a farting-related scene. Yes.
Because Maggie's deaf. For context, Maggie's deaf. And so because it's an unreleased film, there isn't any subtitles.
Also, I'm her sister, and I was, like, hesitating from saying that because it may not be politically correct. But, oh, yeah, she's deaf.
She said it before on the podcast, so I didn't hesitate.
What about you, Carla?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I actually have spent my whole life tracking down weird, obscure stuff. So it didn't really kind of hold that much. And also, like, I've spent a lifetime also of having to let it go when I can't get my hands on it. So I kind of have this detached sort of like, whatever, if it happens, it happens. But you watching my hand with the DVD, like my dog with the treat, really made me fucking freak out. I was like, okay, maybe.
You freaked out.
There was sweat. There was definitely some sweat happening.
Just like him with a dry mouth, just like eye tracking the whole thing moving across the room.
Did you notice the laser pointer on your forehead?
On a different note, I found it so special because, as long-term listeners of the show would know, like, I'm very interested in finding Australian references in everything, and maybe that's my, like, 90s childhood parochial can't get shit here, have to order a copy of The Clockwork Orange with Dutch subtitles because it was illegal here kind of thing. But I loved seeing an Australian, like, a film entirely staffed with Australian actors by Soderbergh. That was, really like, my dream come true, a dream that I never knew that I had.
And that was very interesting because to see that Australian humour, because it was so biased to see that humour in a Soderbergh film was hilarious.
Like, yeah.
Even though I could only see it, couldn't hear it.
Oh, Mags.
But you know what is interesting about that is that I felt like the cast was kind of amazing, like a really exceptional cast who I don't think are exceptional improvisers. So the dialogue in most cases was not very memorable at all.
Are we allowed to talk about the content, Lee?
Maybe.
Is it making you uncomfortable?
It is that thing of where I think when I listen to you guys talk about these films, because I've seen them, I can sort of play along a little bit. I think everyone listening to this hasn't seen it. Mm. So I think just because of that, and I do believe in my heart that one day they will be able to. I can't imagine it'll never be out there one day. Mm. So I think one day they will, but I don't know. Does that mean no spoilers? I don't know. This is uncharted territory for film podcasts, I think.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to so much talk about the plot, but just that the fact that I think that the characterizations and the action was what made it really funny. Like the characters, the sort of the types that they were depicting were very Australian and very funny, very specific to the art world and to the performing arts in, you know, this little niche in our country. So I felt like that was really spot on. But the dialogue itself was, like, not sparkling or, you know, like, it was very much just improvised off the cuff kind of, yeah.
But this was actually a confluence of my two primary worlds, which is the theatre. I have another podcast called Across the Aisle, which is theatre criticism, and Soderbergh in the Australian theatre world. And there was a lot of It was a microcosm of the Sydney Theatre Company at the time as well. Like, there's characters in the play that are meant to be Andrew Upton and Kate Blanchett, played by Australian actors. And I'm like, oh, that's a bit, you know, a bit tongue-in-cheek kind of thing. I loved that riff on this world and seeing it through his eyes. It's like the most perfect artifact for me of all time.
Yeah. I think I should point out, because more than a couple of people associated with the film have made this point to me, because I watched it and I went, oh, it's meant to be Kate Blanchett and Andrew Upton. They run the theatre company, they're husband and wife. One wrote the play and the other is an actor. many people associated with the film have stressed to me that they did not base them, aside from that very superficial thing, because they do play like kind of assholes in the film. And at least one of the actors has said, yeah, they're the nicest people you'll ever meet. And sure. And so, yeah, we absolutely were not basing it on them at all. They stress this many times. I like that I'm not naming them, except I just said we were not basing it. But the thing is, I've met these people and have asked them individually after I've told them that I've seen the film. I then ask questions about it, so I don't think that gives anything away, does it?
So, Kay, if you're listening, you know it's not about you.
But that's why I said it felt very tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. Like, it felt very heightened, a very kind of wry satire about the Australian theatre world.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think it was mean in any way, mean-spirited. I felt like it was genuinely a satire. Yeah.
Well, there was, Damon Herriman plays this amazingly pretentious fae director. And I did ask, oh, who was that based on? It feels so specific. And someone told me, oh, it's based on every director you meet in the theatre.
Yeah,
like, at least 70% of them, you know. So I think, yeah, there are a lot of archetypes that I feel like they all had a lot to draw on from all the people they've worked with in the theatre.
Oh, you could tell with that it was done with great relish.
Yeah.
Like, it was juicy. It was like he was, really sinking his teeth into
reveling in it.
Well, isn't, but that's a beautiful thing. Like, our stage actors, it's like, okay, you play a stage director. You play a theatre company owner, you know, and it's like, let rip, especially with Australians, you know, because we don't shy away from sending up our betters.
Yes, the tall poppy thing is definitely a play in this film. But it's, I don't know, like, it's there are a lot of improvised comedies that just don't work because it feels like the film comes to a standstill as the actors are allowed free range to improvise, and there's a lot of sort of shaggy, unfunny films out there. And this one is, like, they kind of improvise scenes and then stitch it together from that, and it works. Like, this works better than most... I enjoy this film more than most released films I see in any given year.
I agree. But,
it has such a tight structure, though. Like, even though the scenes are improvised or the dialogue's improvised, the way that the film is structured is quite preconceived, you know, the way it works backwards. And you don't realise that until you're sort of halfway through it, that it's all kind of working towards something.
I have actually asked some of the people about this, and apparently, and this blows my mind, that was decided in post. I said, how did you structure this? Like, filming it improvised, like, knowing it would be backwards. And Soderbergh made that decision in post, apparently.
Wow.
And I've since hearing that, I've thought, well, how would this work forwards? And I'm wondering if he did a cut forwards, realised it doesn't quite work, did it backwards. And now, but it feels so deliberate, like the way that the setups and punchlines happen.
It does.
It's just so perfectly revealed. And you get big laughs because of the order it happens in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That brings me to an interesting, you know, something that I was pondering, you know, after watching it. You know, the idea that this is the first draft of a film and that you don't often, I mean, I don't think filmmakers really work in this way generally, the idea of, you know, making a whole film as a first draft on video and then, you know, tightening it up and reshooting it. Like, that's very wasteful and not how you would go about things in a normal standard production. But to me, it's like so interesting because even though, you know, he's not released this film, I would love to see a polished, finished version of this film. Like, I think that it actually has the bones of a really, you know, a really tight, funny, scripted comedy.
Yeah.
I have two things to that. One, Lee and I's friend Paul actually made a film essentially in that way. It's an agile filmmaking technique where they make the film three times.
Wow,
and they stitch together the final product from what they like and what made sense, and they change each iteration from what didn't work. So that's something that
happening. It happens experimentally.
But particularly in Melbourne, there's a business in Melbourne that is focused on helping filmmakers make film in that way. Kylie Eddy, who used to be the managing director at Queer Film Festival, runs that business.
Okay.
But the second thing is that I actually think it's quite fortuitous / not entirely uncoincidental considering how he makes films. But I feel like this film is very much in the same oeuvre as Unsane. And Unsane is maybe like that second iteration because I felt Unsane was still quite unpolished. But it's interesting that there's, 10 years in between those two films, and they could have been released in the same year.
Mm. Yeah.
He's made other films like this as well.
Mm.
Yeah. That sort of, you know, in this world, like
in Hollywood. What was that one called? Again?
Full Frontal.
Full Frontal. Yeah. Wow. So it shares a lot of DNA with Full Frontal, definitely. Does, yeah. But I feel like maybe he just decided, oh, maybe people don't really want to see this
as much.
I loved it too. Maybe in terms of his process now.
Well, how would you release it? How would you release it? You'd have,
I don't know, Netflix or something? I don't know how you'd put it out there.
Yeah. Stan.
But you'd have to kind of frame it as this is not a, you know, you'd have to be able to frame it as what it is.
Yeah.
Otherwise people would be like,
I reckon you should just chuck it on YouTube or whatever repository he has for videos.
Well, it's, I understand there are some tricky rights things, which is of why course. It hasn't yeah, come yeah, out. Yeah, yeah. And of course. Claims of ownership. I don't really know all the details, but I'm sure it has to be resolved one day. Or, you know, if it isn't resolved, I imagine someone, not me, never me, will sneak it out onto the internet. And then everyone can enjoy the glory that is The Last Time I Saw Michael Gray.
All right, shall we move on?
Okay, let's talk about Sawyer Valentini in Boston, year zero. Obviously, I would recommend sensors on all your doors and windows, and I would swap the terrace doors out for a steel cord door. Update your deadbolts. I want to talk to you about situational awareness, okay? Where's the nearest police station? Where's the nearest fire station? These are things that should always be right on the tip of your tongue. Yeah, parking. I know you have parking in the rear of the building with a back entrance. I'm going to ask you not to use that anymore. I know it's convenient, but I would advocate selling your car and using a ride service. If you can't or won't do that, I would say park on the street, preferably under a light source, and come back and walk through this courtyard here where people can see you. With your keys in your hand, by the way. You want your keys always in your hand. You don't want to be digging around in your purse in the dark for your keys. And I'll talk to you about and help you with a go bag, you know, just cash, credit cards, change of clothes, flashlight, charger, that kind of thing, a firearm, if you're open to that idea of purchasing and registering a firearm and learning how to use it. Think about altering your routine when you go to work, when you leave work, that kind of thing. How about social media? Are you on any social media accounts?
I'm on Facebook, but my account's private, so.
Right, okay, that's no good, because he'd be able to, figure out a friend of yours from marching band or a sorority sister and go get photos from them, create a bogus account, and then try to friend you that way. Your friends know your email, that's enough, just delete the Facebook today. And then talk to your friends, you know, be open about this, inform them what's going on, tell them not to mention you, don't tag you on Instagram, you know, baby showers or Chardonnay day with the girls or, you know, whatever it is. If there's someone's taking a picture, you do whatever you can to get out of it. All right? And think of your cell phone as your enemy and this, your new best friend.
Thematically, Unsane is a logical step, I think, in Soderbergh's canon. He's always been attracted to stories about the insidious scourge of American capitalism and the shitmen and the voyeurism, mental health issues that all come with it. As per usual with Soderbergh, the medium suits the message. In this case, shooting on iPhone is spot on. Sawyer Valentini, played to perfection by Claire Foy, is a victim of stalking, trying desperately to lead a normal life despite the constant threat of being watched and life interfered with by a man who is obsessed with her. The way the film is shot overall is voyeurism 101 with a spy cam CCTV vibe. The camera sitting up high, looking down, watching unobserved from a distance, from behind bushes, through windows and around corners. It presents a heightened atmosphere of surveillance and the constant churning of background data aggregation, which, if you sign the wrong document, can land you in the nut house. Like the unethical inner workings of Big Pharma in Contagion and Side Effects, Unsane depicts a dystopian vision of America's mental health system and their exploitation of people for profit, a world in which an evil hospital administrator insists that people leave here healthier than when they came in. This is also a world in which the psychotic man is more likely to get a job in a mental health facility without background checks than a traumatized woman is to be protected from him. Unsane explicitly addresses the tropes of toxic masculinity that have been identified, recorded, and classified in the wake of online feminism and its campaigns such as Gamergate and Me Too. The film addresses the appalling fact that under attack, women are expected to take full responsibility for protecting themselves. Enter Matt Damon in a tongue-in-cheek cameo as an efficient down-to-earth business cop who teaches... who teaches Sawyer everything she needs to know about personal security, finally presenting her with the very helpful self-help book, The Gift of Fear. Sawyer is satisfyingly complex. She's not sweet. She's competitive, aggressively sexual and defiant. She has a tender side, but she's always in survival mode and has to lock it away due to her experience of being hunted. Her stalker is a quiet, nerdy, seemingly harmless guy who sees Sawyer as a feminine, sweet angel and insists that this isn't you when she forces him to see the real her. It's only when she lies unconscious before him that he says, "Now I feel like I'm looking at the real you." There's one very dated subplot, I thought, which was a bit disappointing, but her bunk neighbour in the asylum does her best playing a evil psycho lesbian, sort of like Catherine Zeta-Jones and Rooney Mara in Side Effects. And she ends up falling under the sword to advance the plot. But mostly I love how these themes and tropes unfold in this darkly comedic, over-the-top B-film schlock thriller tones. I think it works really well. How about you guys?
Yeah, I had written here it's the thriller for the Me Too generation. So I think you're spot on there. I think it was quite self-conscious that, like, there's this whole backdrop of just everyday microaggressions and everyday sexism that pervade almost every aspect of the film. Like every single scene refers to some form of, you know...
women not being believed.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just general sexism that women face. I think that scene with Matt Damon where he's like, you know, kind of analysing her housing situation and breaking down all the things she's going to need to do to keep herself safe from the stalker. It's like... you know, the irony of that is that that's just shit that women have to do anyway. Like, that's not even, like, you know, I think there's a deliberate irony there that, like, that's just life for women. I felt that towards the end of the film, like, I enjoyed, I think, like, 85% of it. Towards the end of the film, I feel like I lost a bit of momentum. And maybe by the end of it, I felt like it was too schlocky for the subject matter. Like, the subject matter is too grave or something that they're attempting to kind of, you know, do justice to, the end result was it felt a little bit trivializing. But I don't know. Yeah.
That's interesting.
What did other people think?
I see how you feel that way, but I sort of saw it in a different way. I just took it as a Soderbergh situation, which was genre cross zeitgeist. And it was very much like an asylum horror film. But I did spend most of the film wondering what it would look like if there could be a male protagonist in this film. And I don't actually think there could be. Like, I just don't think that kind of situation could happen to a man.
Well, there were some deliberate nods to Misery.
Yes, absolutely. We have with the hammer and the ankle. Yeah. I really liked this. I thought it looked like shit at the cinema and I was really disappointed, especially like there's some really bad lighting.
Really washed out.
Really bad lighting scenes. But I watched it at home on my projector and it looked fine. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether I've just kind of softened my opinion of it and I was like, harsh. No. Okay, yeah.
It's because of the way it was shot. So the iPhone, even if it's 4K, has 4K capability, it's still not going to be able to capture, like the lens is tiny compared to a proper camera, so it's still not going to get the gradient of, you know, tone that a real camera could.
And I just think also, like, it's an experiment of form for him and there was just some scenes that weren't lit properly. Like, he tried to use natural light. The scenes that were in natural light and also in sort of twilight worked really well, but there was also some scenes indoors that he either purposefully or just didn't get the lighting right, and I expect that these things will be corrected for the next iPhone film that he makes, which he says it's the only film that it's the only format he wants to use going forward. Really? Yeah.
Because I just thought, that for this film it suited it because of the subject matter. But I don't think you should make every film Nightfall.
I do love it at a time where you've got, you know, your Christopher Nolans and your PTAs going, I'm only going to shoot films on 35 or 70 millimeter and nothing less. So DeBoe's like, I will only shoot on that thing in my pocket.
Yeah.
The phone, that's all I'm making. I love that.
I thought he did some amazing colour effects. Given it was iPhone, like, he, you know, his love of blue and yellow as a dichotomy is just like really coming to full effect there.
I thought it was a really good dumb horror movie that made me actually quite mad with the whole like feminist undertones. But we have a male person of the species here.
Oh, me.
Yeah.
Oh.
How did you feel about it?
I actually haven't seen it since the cinema. So I'm sort of going partly off a vague memory and the notes I wrote at the time. Yeah, I mean, it's a Sony film, so I automatically love it more than most other things. But I felt it didn't quite work, and I think part of that is that it's like, I love his verite style, and it makes everything feel much more relatable, much more grounded, like something you've shot on your phone maybe, so, you know, oh my God, this could happen. And yet the plot mechanics are so schlocky, and it really feels like an airport novel. And I kind of wish he'd gone the way he did when he made Contagion, and you could feel him deliberately shooting it in a different way to Traffic, so he wasn't repeating himself. Mm. But you still kind of feel like maybe the Traffic style would have worked for this story.
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Well, that's another conversation we can have.
No, that's fair enough, but I think with Unsane, I think maybe if he'd gone in a completely other direction and shot it like, I'm trying to think, who's a hack filmmaker? Anyway, someone who does it in like really over the top schlocky style, I would have liked to have seen if that would have worked. It might not have. But I did sort of feel the style of the script and the style of the filmmaking sort of butting heads a little bit. I love Claire Foy in it.
Mm. She's incredible.
I haven't seen the show she's in. Is it The Crown or The Queen?
Yeah, The Crown.
The Clown, as I like to call it.
the day The Crown caught Clyde. No, I really like her. I'll definitely, you know, see anything she's in. I've also written down, because I don't really remember what happened, can someone explain this note that I've written down? And I think I'm relating it back to Out of Sight. I wrote down sexy boot scene.
Yeah.
What do I mean by that?
Yeah, it's not sexy, but there is a boot scene.
Only
that
if
I
you're
thought,
a creep.
Yes. Yeah,
I think I was being ironic, but I don't remember.
You were being ironic because I thought of Out of Sight during that scene as well. Yeah. It's hard not to because she, you know, it's shot inside the boot.
It's like, a nod.
Right.
It's a night vision type scene where she wakes up in the boot and she's trying to like figure out what's going on.
And actually that is where I felt like, for me, and it didn't jump the shark, like it still kind of made it to the end, but I felt like that was a moment where I was like, are you really making a joke about Out of Sight right now? Like, it just felt a little bit inappropriate to what was actually happening. She was being kidnapped by her stalker, and
I didn't make the connection
at all. I didn't either. I think if a guy's going to make a film about this theme and these, you know, ideas, it has to be over the top schlock all the way. Otherwise, I'm just sick of seeing, you know, dead women and traumatized women in crime and, you know, all of those kind of things. So, like, if Sodi's going to do it, it has to be this tone all the way through.
So what I'm hearing from both of you, and it's the same thing that I feel, is that it didn't shit or get off the pot. Like, it needed to, like, be completely horror film tastic, crazy, lots of screaming, or something a little bit more.
Yeah, I just felt it lost energy towards the end.
I agree. Yeah.
I kind of would have liked it to be, I mean, I guess spoiler alert, I don't know. I would have liked it to all have been in her head because of the style of the shooting, but because it wasn't, I wanted a bit more.
Yeah, that's
a
question I had actually. Was it in her head?
I don't think it was.
Like, it kind of, there was a, you know, I think that was a problem for me because it kind of hinted at that. In the hospital,
right.
Kind of had that element, and
the
then
first
it just
time
sort of
I saw
backed
it,
away
I did,
from that, you know.
The first time I saw it, I did spend half of the film going, "Is this real?"
Yeah.
Like, you know, the stalker and all that kind of stuff, or is she really having some kind of psychotic break?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was alluded to in that way,
And that's kind of clumsy because you kind of do feel like that halfway through the film, and then suddenly it's all happening and. You know,
I didn't feel like that until the end of the film, like the final scene where she kind of approaches the man who she thinks is, you know, she's having a sort of paranoid delusion or whatever. And then I was like, was she imagining the whole thing? You know, like, is this, like, did this never actually happen? Yeah. So I felt like that was like, why muddy the waters now? Like, yeah, but I don't know.
Mm. I think there's a lot of plot holes.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even more so because of Claire Foy. I think she really carried it.
Yeah.
And she is amazing in The Clown. You should definitely see it.
I love clowns, so I will definitely watch it.
And also, back to my note about Michael Gregg, this film was also shot in 10 days.
What?
So there you go.
Double figures. Why does it take so long? 9 days, Soderbergh. Come on.
Step up your game. All right, now it's time to press pause. Press pause.
I've got a great one because I was actually really, and I think it kind of detracted from the film for me. I was really fascinated by the mechanics of the iPhone direction, the actual sort of, I guess it's principal photography essentially. And here's one to say that to get the dolly shots, I just thought maybe he just had a selfie stick,
yeah,
you know, on a track, but really he had a dolly. He had the iPhone on what's called a DJI gimbal. I have no idea what that is. I'm assuming it's some kind of like pedestal or clamp. It was sitting in a wheelchair and a crew member pushed. Oh, he was sitting in a wheelchair and a crew member pushed him around. How the dolly shots got taken.
That's Breathless. That's how they did dolly shots in Breathless. Quite honestly, yeah, that's amazing. Wow. That was deliberate.
That has to stay in depth.
doing your own sound effects.
Oh, and I've got one more. During the scene when Nate leads the group discussion, Full Frontal is on the TV in the background.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Huh.
So it was a reference.
That's neat. This is like not a this is about Michael Gregg, but Damon Herriman was in The Big Steal, which is something that's like a bit of a shared thing for me, Carla and Maggie, because we went and watched that together at MIFF last year. Yeah.
And, also separately as children.
Yeah, separately as
in
children.
In the 90s. One of our favorites. Endlessly.
Millions of times. So, yeah, it was really nice to see Damon Herriman in a film. He's fantastic. Yeah, really, really love him.
For all of our non-Australian, well, for anyone who hasn't seen the film, watch the Australian film, The Big Steal.
Yeah.
And he's about to be, I imagine everyone's going to know him soon because he's about to play Charles Manson in the Tarantino thing.
Oh, really?
What?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, he's got quite the career in America now, doesn't he? He was in Justified as a hick.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
I've got to watch that. I have a press pause about Michael Gregg. I love that that Michael Gregg himself, the director, looks like Soderbergh.
Yes.
Bald glasses.
I
love like going through his films and finding the guy who looks like Soderbergh.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that a lot. My other press pause is about this podcast itself, because I've been listening since day one, huge fan, completely honored to be on twice. I feel like you've made it just for me because this is totally my jam and I get excited every time there's a new episode. And yet, despite listening to it for the last year and a half, it was only a few weeks ago that I got the title. Now, I am, as a professional comedy writer, I deal in puns. I would make jokes about Soderbergh and Sodi and sodas. I've been doing that for a long time. And only recently did I put together Club Soderbergh. Oh, my God, that's brilliant. So I am very embarrassed, but a belated kudos for the best title you could have come up with for a Soderbergh podcast.
Well, Andrew came up with it, actually.
Maggie's partner.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
He's a punner.
But can we talk about Soderbergh then? So apparently that's like the European pronunciation of the name, and that's one that I have been heard bandied around. And I was like, well, do we know any definitive pronunciation from the man himself, or is it just all anecdotal?
Yeah, I heard people saying Soderbergh recently.
Soderbergh.
There's got to be a commentary. Maybe the commentary for Schizopolis, where he interviews himself. Maybe honestly, it's like left speaker, right speaker, and it's almost better than the film. Maybe he said it in that. I'm going to go tracking back through commentary tracks and interviews, see if he's ever pronounced it. Because until you said that, it never occurred to me. that maybe we've been saying it wrong this whole time.
Yeah. Oh, and that our pun is null and void, but apparently most people don't get it anyway. So it doesn't matter.
No, it's fine. I drink soda all the time. My favourite drink.
Good one.
Oh, well, on that note, let's all go grab a soda. And that concludes Club Soderberg for now. Thanks, Lee, for coming by and helping us complete Sodi.
My pleasure.
And to the rest of you guys, you better believe we'll be back soon. High Flying Bird and The Laundromat will both be coming out in 2019. So stay subscribed to us on your potty apps and we will pop up sooner than you think. If you haven't already caught up on our earlier episodes, they're all there. You can watch them on or listen to them on SoundCloud and Beyond Pod, TuneIn, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, as always, to Zeph Anastasio, who stares blankly at the wall and tunes out while we do this podcast. You're great.
Never watch a Soderbergh film.
Going to keep the conversation going on our Facebook and Twitter accounts at Club Soderbergh, so follow us to keep up to date with all the Soderbergh goss. We'd love to hear from you, hear about your impressions of Soderbergh, of your favourite bits of trivia, your own press pauses. Send them in. We want to know. And until we meet again... Adieu.